are such that they are operators or whatnot that have commutation relations of this kind, where there should be an identity operator over here. We will usually omit the identity operator here. You see, these things are going to be maps on Hilbert spaces, operators, therefore, the phi and the pi, and therefore the commutator too is some operator on Hilbert space, whereas here really we have functions and numbers. So in order to make this also an operator on Hilbert space, we should always in our mind add or multiply here with the identity operator. The operators phi hat of x and t should commute with the phi hat of x prime and t, and the canonically conjugate momentum ones also should commute with each other. Remember that this is very similar to the situation in ordinary quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, we may have a few position operators, q, and a few momentum operators, p, functions of time, and operators of on Hilbert space. At every point in time, you get an operator on Hilbert space. We label the various position operators with an index little a, and the various momentum operators with an index little a prime, subscript a prime. Then the canonical commutation relations are that the q's and the p's commute if they are belonging to different degrees of freedom. So if a is different from a prime, so the position x commutes with the momentum in the y direction, etc. And it's ih bar if they are of the same degree of freedom. The position operators all commute with each other. The momentum operators all commute with each other. In principle, if we have a lot of particles, we can have a lot of indices here. So as a runs from 1 to 3, we would get the positions x, y, z of the first particle. Then maybe a runs further from 4 to 5 to 6. This would be the x, y, z positions of the second particle, and so on. You could have this index a run through a lot of numbers to enumerate the positions of a lot of particles, and the same for the momenta. But usually in quantum mechanics, this index is discrete. Okay? So we have a countable number of degrees of freedom. Could be an Avogadro number of them, lots of them, 10 to the 30 perhaps, if it's a huge system with lots of particles in there. But it's still countably many. Not so over here. Here we have that for every x, and x plays the role of the index a here, for every x we have another operator phi hat. And for every x prime, another operator pi hat, just like we have for every a, a q, and for every prime, a p, for every a prime, a p. Only that here the a's are running through discrete values, and the x's and the x prime run through a continuum of values. In fact, x and x prime are members of R3. So we have plenty of those. Oh, I talked too long. So we have plenty of those operators, of those phi's and those pi's. And the commutator is not really a Kronecker delta, it's a Dirac delta. But again, the degrees of freedom at one position and another position commute with each other. Also, the canonically conjugate momenta commute with each other. So whereas in ordinary quantum mechanics, the q's describe positions, it's very different here. What is the phi hat? Phi hat is the amplitude of a field at the position x. That's the degree of freedom here, similar to one of those positions here. We have that at every x, we have a degree of freedom. The field may go up, the field may go down in amplitude, but it's the amplitude of the field, like the strength of the electromagnetic field. It's just that the electromagnetic field is vector valued, whereas the phi is just scalar value, number value. But other than that, it's the same thing. You can think of it like a pressure wave or so. That would be scalar. So phi is the amplitude of a field at point x and t, and pi is the rate of change of the amplitude. Okay, so we will have to find mathematical objects that obey this for quantizing a field. And then, as usual in quantum theory, we will keep the equations of motion from the classical theory. In the classical theory, we have that the canonically conjugate momenta are given by the time derivatives of the degrees of freedom, just like the momenta are really just the velocities up to a constant like the mass. And the other equation of motion, the key equation of motion other than that one, is of course the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, this is phi hat dot is really pi, pi hat dot is really phi hat double dot, because pi hat is phi dot, right? So this is just the second time derivative, and therefore this whole thing is the Klein-Gordon equation. We will leave that unchanged. Also, classical theory has it that the field that we are considering is real number valued. Its amplitudes are real numbers. We translate that into the quantum theory by requiring that the expectation values are real. And that means that the fields will have to be Hermitian operators. We don't know yet what kind of operators, on what Hilbert space they act, but we will want them to be Hermitian or self-adjoint so that the expectation values at least are real. So there you have it. This is the mathematical problem of a scalar quantum field theory in Minkowski space. That's all we have to do. We have to find some phi hat of x and t, probably operators on Hilbert space, which obey all of these equations simultaneously. Oh, well. Okay. So that's the whole mathematical problem. Just solve these equations all together, and we are done. Oh, and just for completeness, yes, so this equation has, in quantum mechanics, the analog that q hat dot is p, and of course the Klein-Gordon equation has the quantum mechanical analog of pi hat dot is minus kq for a harmonic oscillator. So it looks very similar, but it's not quite the same, obviously. But we will use the similarity between the new equations of quantum field theory and the old well-known equations of the quantum harmonic oscillators in order to solve those equations, the green ones. Namely, we will massage those equations, transform them around until they break up into lots of equations which are identical to these guys. And then we do know how to solve these. We do know how to solve the harmonic oscillator in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And just generally, we know everything about the harmonic oscillator. The ground state wave function is a Gaussian, and then the excited states are Hermite functions, etc. All of this we can use in order to solve that problem here. Just have to massage and transform these equations until we can find a mathematical structure which is identical to this one, and then we can solve it. Now, remember the equations of motion? Here they are. Equation of motion that says that phi dot is pi, and the Klein-Gordon equation. These two equations, we discussed it already in the last lecture. These two equations are actually Heisenberg equations of motion. That's not trivial, because that's not where they came from. Remember, this equation came from the argumentation that, well, the momentum ought to be the time derivative of the degree of freedom. And that equation came also from somewhere else. That is really the Klein-Gordon equation. And it came from trying to make the Schrödinger equation special relativistically covariant. But now I'm saying that those two equations are really Heisenberg equations of motion. They are just regular equations of motion that follow in the usual quantum mechanical way from a Hamiltonian. There is a Hamiltonian which will generate this time evolution. And that Hamiltonian is this one down here. I think I showed you in the last lecture. The last lecture contained the derivation of one of the two equations of motion from the Hamiltonian, and the other one was left as an exercise. If you find that you have difficulties with this, let me know after class. So this claim that the two equations of motion follow in this usual way from a Hamiltonian is very analogous to what's going on in quantum mechanics. Namely, the usual way that equations of motion in the Heisenberg picture are derived is that you take the Hamiltonian of the system, and then if you want to know what's the equation of motion for the observable Q, then you write down IH bar Q dot is equal to the commutator of Q with H. Okay? If you're not completely familiar with this, ask me for my lecture notes on quantum mechanics. If you want to know what is the equation of motion of another observable, like the angular momentum or whatever you want, if you, let's say you want to know what the equation of motion is of the momentum, then you just write down IH bar P hat dot is equal to the commutator of P with H. Whatever observable's equation of motion you want, the time derivative of it is the commutator with the Hamiltonian. Same deal here. We want to know what is the equation of motion of phi, then the Heisenberg equation of motion is IH bar, time derivative of phi is equal to the commutator of phi with Hamiltonian. Same for pi. If you chose any other observable of our quantum field theory, any other polynomial of phi with pi, for example, and you wanted to know what is the time evolution of that polynomial in phi and pi, well, the time derivative of that polynomial is given by the commutator of that polynomial with H. By the way, do you see that there is something non-trivial about that statement? Remember, the equation of motion for phi is given in this way. The equation of motion for pi is given in this way. For any other observable, which might be any other function of phi and pi, the equation of motion is also given in this way that the time derivative of that observable is given by the commutator of that observable with H. It's non-trivial that this is even working out. Totally non-trivial that this works out. But why does it? Why is it non-trivial, first of all? Well, if you have a polynomial of the phi and the pi, then the time derivative of that polynomial will produce, through the product rule, a lot of terms. Okay? We produce a lot of terms. And eventually, you just get the time derivative of phi and pi after you differentiate the whole polynomial, right? And on the right-hand side, what do you have? You have a polynomial in phi and pi commuted with h. That, too, gives you lots of terms. Because remember, when you have the product of two operators in a commutator, then you can work that out. There are rules for working out commutators. They must do the same thing. The product rule for differentiations here must match what the rules of the game are for commutators when you have the product of two operators in here. And they do match that. Try it out. Just calculate what the time evolution is of the operator phi pi phi, for example. Okay? They match. And in fact, this is the reason why these are the Heisenberg equations of motion. There is no choice what you have on the right-hand side. The right-hand side has to be the commutator because everything else wouldn't be consistent with the Leibniz rule here on the left-hand side, the product rule, the Leibniz rule. Right? So the Leibniz rule on the left-hand side, the fact that you're having time derivatives determines that the right-hand side has to be exactly this, the commutator with the observable. This is just a comment that goes back to ordinary quantum mechanics. And it carries forward to quantum field theory too. I just wanted to make this comment because it explains why the Heisenberg equations of motion are those. It couldn't be any different. It wouldn't be consistent otherwise. Okay, so if you plug this Hamiltonian into these two equations and work out the commutator, you get those two equations of motion over here. These ones. So the Hamiltonian for our quantum field theory is this. So we are working with a quantum system, and that quantum system consists of a field, phi, everywhere in space. It's a huge quantum system. It's not like an atom, which is sort of very localized. No. We deal with a quantum system that's huge. It fills all of space. It's the phi quantum system with its degrees of freedom, namely the amplitude at every point in space. And that's the expression for the energy of that total system. A system that is spread out all over all of space, total energy, the total energy operator is this one. It gives you the total energy of the system, and H is also generating the time evolution, namely in this way. Okay, so remember our plan was this. Our plan for doing quantum field theory on Minkowski space. We recalled how harmonic oscillators work, relativistic fields. This was, you know, E equal mc squared, and how you go from the Schrödinger equation to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we did second quantization. And now let's look at how we can identify harmonic oscillators as being the building blocks of a quantum field. Once we identify the building blocks of a quantum field as harmonic oscillators, we will be able to solve the quantum field theory. We'll be able to solve the canonical commutation relations along with the equations of motion, along with hermeticity conditions. And by the way, we will also be able to calculate quantum fluctuations of fields on this basis. Okay. So, harmonic oscillators in quantum fields. Intuitively, it's clear that quantum fields, just like regular classical fields, should be full of harmonic oscillators because that's what they like to do. They like to do sine and cosine waves. That's what fields do. Okay, so remember our mathematical problem is we have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation simultaneously with the canonical commutation relations. Yep?
So this formula implies that there is a creation and annihilation of particles because it is equivalent to the harmonic oscillator?
Not yet. We will see how that arises. For now, let's just accept the mathematical challenge that we want to solve the equations of motion of the field subject to the condition that also the canonical commutation relations hold. And we will solve that problem, get a mathematical way of solving that, and then we will see what the interpretation of it is. And we will see how that can be interpreted now as a theory of particles that are flying around, but it can also be interpreted as a theory of fields, of quantized fields. And you will start with the quantized fields. Remember, I said at the very beginning of the course that the standard point of view about quantum field theory up until the 90s was that it's all about particles. Because in detectors, in particle accelerators, what they see is particles. And we certainly will get to the particle picture. But there is also a field aspect. And that is being, that played out in cosmology. We can now measure that part as well. So we will look at both the particle picture interpretation as well as the wave picture interpretation. In fact, at the beginning, we will focus on the wave picture interpretation. And we will find that the particle picture interpretation has its limitations. There are situations when there is no interpretation of what is going on in terms of particles. It's not only that the particle number is uncertain, it's just that the notion of particle doesn't apply. I can give you a rough interpretation of why that, a rough indication of why that will be. The harmonic oscillators have equidistant energy level spacing, and that will translate into the statement that all the phi particles are identical. If you create one phi particle of less momentum, or another phi particle of that momentum, or another phi particle of that momentum, mathematically it will be just going up the ladder of the harmonic oscillator. Have it fourfold excited means four particles of that momentum. Have it tenfold excited, that harmonic oscillator for a particular wavelength, means you have 10 particles of that wavelength. But sometimes in cosmology, it can happen that those harmonic oscillators have their, actually it happens all the time in cosmology on curved space, that those harmonic oscillators, which usually have a potential like this, can have a potential that is changing. As the space-time is dynamic, the potential of the harmonic oscillators is changing. Now, that makes for some interesting physics of those harmonic oscillators, particle creation, particle annihilation. Even without particle scattering, you can have particle creation, particle annihilation, because those harmonic oscillators can get excited just because the potential is varying. That's parametric excitation. But even much wilder, it can happen that the potential goes flat and flips over. And then you have an inverted harmonic oscillator potential. An inverted harmonic oscillator potential doesn't have a discrete spectrum. It has a continuum of spectrum. It is a continuous spectrum. And there is simply no particle interpretation in that case. There's no equidistant ladder. You can't say there are so many particles or whatever. There is no particle interpretation. During the early stages of the universe, it is thought that this happened. It actually went like that, the potential. And there was no particle interpretation whatsoever. Okay, so mathematically, for now, we're just concerned with solving the problem of solving the equations of motion, solving the canonical commutation relations. For convenience, I changed the notation. I'm not writing stuff in terms of pi all the time. I may sometimes use phi dot. Same thing, right? At least so far in Minkowski space, the two things are the same. Phi dot and pi are the same thing. So the Klein-Gordon equation takes this somewhat nicer form, and the canonical commutation relations take this form. Oops. Okay, so how to solve these equations? Strategy will be, we use the similarity to the harmonic oscillators, as we said. However, there are a few technical difficulties that need to be overcome along the way. First difficulty. The first difficulty in the quest to reformulate quantum field theory such that we can use our knowledge of harmonic oscillators. Well, let us look at the Klein-Gordon equation. It is analogous to a harmonic oscillator equation. Remember, a harmonic oscillator equation says that P dot is equal to minus K, which is the spring constant, times the elongation. Okay, so it's like MA equal to minus KX. That's the harmonic oscillator equation. It's a basic equation of motion of the harmonic oscillator, where K is some sort of constant. And we know how to solve this in terms of sines, cosines, and whatnot, and we also know how to solve it quantum mechanically. This looks very much similar. We have here pi dot, check, that's very similar to the p dot. Yes, here we have indices A for various degrees of freedom. Here we have an index X, which runs through a continuum. But we can live with that for now. Then on the right-hand side, we have a phi, our degree of freedom. Check, yes, here we have the Q, fine. So we have the QA degree of freedom. Here we have the phi of X degrees of freedom, fine. But how about this business here? This is supposed to be the spring constant. It's a number. Yeah, it might be different for every degree of freedom, but it's still, for every degree of freedom, just a number. Not so here. This thing is not a number. We have derivatives in here. So that's a problem. We cannot simply say that this is for each x a harmonic oscillator, the same way we would say for each a this is a harmonic oscillator. Right? If we hold a fixed, this is a harmonic oscillator. If we hold x fixed, this is not a harmonic oscillator. Because the derivatives care about the neighboring x's as well. Because the derivative is obtained by Newton-Leibniz limit, or two Newton-Leibniz limits, because this is a second derivative. So it's not a number. What can we do? Well, standard trick is to use the fact that under Fourier transform, derivatives turn into multiplications with the independent variable. So let us transform this thing here into something that is number valued. And the Fourier transform can do that for us. So here's the Fourier transform. I remember there are many Fourier transforms. And in the project that I will outline soon, in an email to everybody. Oh, by the way, if you have not yet signed up on our emailing list, please do so, so that you are in the loop. Remember, there are many kinds of Fourier transforms. There's discrete Fourier transform, there's Fourier sine, there's Fourier cosine transforms, and so on. In the project, we will use a Fourier sine transform. But this is just a regular Fourier transform here. So we take our field, which depends on x, and we multiply with the Fourier factor. This is a standard prefactor here, 2 pi to the power of minus 3 half. There's actually an h-bar in this as well, but h-bar we set equal to 1 by choosing our units appropriately. And when we write xk, what we really mean is the sum from I equal 1 to 3 xi ki. This is the Fourier transform from the field, from the quantum field phi hat of x and t to a quantum field phi hat of k and t. Standard Fourier transform, except that we don't know what it means. Because we don't know what the phi is yet, right? Are the phi going to be 3 by 3 matrices, or what are they going to be? They're going to be infinite by infinite matrices, or operators, or whatever. So let's agree that whatever the phi later is going to be, this is a Fourier transform which is component-wise. If you think of this as a matrix, each component of that matrix will be exposed to that Fourier transform. That's just how we want to define it. Because remember, so far this is just symbols. We haven't solved the problem yet. Okay, so now at this point, let me switch to a more traditional notation. It's just that in this community, usually the field phi of k and t is written slightly differently. Namely, instead of saying that it's phi with the k within that bracket, the k is written as a subscript. This is basically to make it look similar to quantum mechanics, where we have, you know, that subscript down here that counts the degrees of freedom. And so in cosmology or in the community that studies quantum field theory in curved space, the tradition is to write what normally would be written as phi hat of k and t, and totally justifiably so. It's written usually as phi subscript k of t, but it's totally the same thing. It's just another way of writing it. And there's also some terminology attached to this, namely phi hat of k and t is called the k mode of the quantum field. The mode is one Fourier component. You know, k is the wave vector. It's the momentum. It's giving us the wavelength. And even though it doesn't carry a vector symbol or indices, remember that this is really a three-component vector here. Now, if we're given the phi hat k of t, if we're given that, then we can recover by inverse Fourier transform what the phi hat of x and t is. Namely, take the phi hat k of t, multiply with the inverse Fourier factor. Here's a minus, there's a plus. The same prefactor here. And integrate it over all of the momenta, and you get phi hat of x and t back. So as you go from the Fourier transform to the inverse Fourier transform, you only have to check that the Fourier transform from positions to momenta has a minus sign. The Fourier transform from momenta to positions doesn't. Other than that, they look just the same. Okay, so now, and I leave that to you as an exercise to verify. If you Fourier transform your field, then you can re-express the Hamilton operator. And the Hamilton operator, expressed in terms of the Fourier transformed field, looks like this. Which is, I guess, totally as expected. Because it looks pretty much the same as what we had in position space, with two notable changes. One is that, as expected, what used to be the Laplacian second space derivative, d by dx1 squared plus d by dx2 squared plus d by dx3 squared, becomes k1 squared plus k2 squared plus k3 squared. Actually, with a minus sign, sorry, because there are two i's. Okay, so we have that the derivatives have gone away, and we have just the k squared in here. Another change is that in position space, we used to have here a phi hat of x and t and a phi hat of x and t. Here, however, we have a dagger too. And here we have a dagger as well. Why is that? Well, it's because when you take a real valued function and you take its Fourier transform, it's no longer, then the Fourier transform is not real valued. It's generally complex valued. Okay? So our phi was real valued classically, quantum mechanical self-adjoint. When you do the Fourier transform, it's no longer real, so we have to distinguish that, and this is how it comes out. Just be careful about this. Then the canonical commutation relations come out this way. If you just Fourier transform all the fields, the field and its canonically conjugate. And what happened to the equation of motion? This is really why we did it. But the equation of motion is still, the equations of motion are still of the form that the canonically conjugate momentum field, now as a function of decay, is still the time derivative of the phi. That's nice. And the Klein-Gordon equation now takes this form in terms of the phi and the pi k. And the second derivatives, the Laplace operator, really has gone away. And instead of it, we have this k squared, which is perfect. Because this makes the equation of motion look just like the equation of motion of a harmonic oscillator if we hold k fixed. See here, this is the equation of motion of a harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics again. For each fixed value of a, it's a harmonic oscillator. Here, for each fixed value of k, this is directly, strictly a harmonic oscillator. Because we have here some momentum variable, and it really is a momentum because it's the time derivative of the phi. So some momentum derivative equal to minus some number for each fixed k, that's just a number, times the phi. So it would seem that we can go right ahead and use everything we know about solving quantum harmonic oscillators to solve the quantum field theory over here, because the equation of motion completely matches. There's only one slight difference, which is that the a's take discrete values, the k's take continuous values in R3, three-dimensional momentum space. Already we can read off what the frequency is of those harmonic oscillators. Namely, we know from quantum mechanics that this spring constant is the square of the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So we predict that the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is going to be the square root of this. I leave it to you as an exercise as well to check that the Hamiltonian, here we go, the Hamiltonian in momentum space, together with the equations of motion of Heisenberg, the Heisenberg equations of motion, really gives us, again, these two equations of motion. And it does. Just a little bit of gymnastics to do it. But we're not done yet. There's a second difficulty. A second difficulty that we face when we try to reduce the quantum field theory problem to harmonic oscillators. Namely, we notice that the equations of motion are of the right form, there is still some issue with the canonical commutation relations. Namely, compare these commutation relations with these commutation relations. Here we have a Dirac delta. Here we have a Kronecker delta. And that makes a difference because if the degrees of freedom are identical, this is IH bar times the identity. Here, if the degrees of freedom are the same, then this is IH bar times not defined, infinity, right? So we'll have to somehow deal with this. Yes?
Should that be delta 3k minus k prime? Or?
Yes, you're already spotting something. That's going to be another difficulty. That's right, because this thing is not peaking when k is equal to k prime. It's peaking when k is equal to minus k prime. Yes. Okay. So it's correct as it stands with the plus. right? We'll just have to deal with it eventually. Okay, so how can we deal with this? How can we actually turn this into a Kronecker delta? But the idea is to solve that is that we use a Fourier series expansion instead of the Fourier transform that we just used. So let's go back to square one and say, okay, Fourier transform was a good try, but maybe we should do a Fourier series expansion. But under which circumstances do we get the Fourier series expansion? We can't do a Fourier series expansion for a function that's defined on the entire R3. But if we are dealing with a function, fields, which are defined only in a finite box, then we can do a Fourier series expansion. So let's do that. Let's consider quantum field theory only in a finite box. That box can be big, though. You may make it as big as 100 billion light years, which is way bigger than we can see. But it has the mathematical advantage that we will find Kronecker deltas instead of Dirac deltas. Of course, if we put our system in a box, if we consider quantum field theory in a box, then we have to define the boundary conditions at the side of the box. And that's totally unphysical, because 100 billion light years from here, there is no boundary. There's no boundary conditions to be imposed. But since this is so far away, it doesn't really matter what we assume about the boundary condition, because it would take 100 billion years for that physics to propagate to us. It cannot affect us. So if we make the box large enough, it doesn't matter that we have a box at all. Not for the physics, but it can make a mathematical difference that is useful. Yep.
This box normalization, is it just a mathematical convenience?
Or it's just a mathematical convenience, yes.
It's provided to the theory. If we don't do it, we still have QFT.
Yes. So it's just a mathematical trick. For us, for our purposes at the moment, it's a mathematical trick. But there are circumstances where this is really the case. For example, in so-called cavity QED. You can take mirrors and study light which is bouncing between mirrors. Or basically just have a box where the sides are high quality mirrors, and then you can study what happens in there. And that's very much, it's very precisely described by what we will do now. And that's actual physics that's happening. But of course, we are interested here in fundamental physics, not the study of mirrors. So what I'm saying is, yes, it describes the physics of a box with mirrored sides, but the mirrors don't play any role if the box is large enough, because the mirrors will be very, very far away. The trick of studying quantum field theory in a large box is called infrared regularization. And the term infrared is historical. Infrared is a key word, is a code word, which means long wavelength. It doesn't actually mean wavelengths of a micrometer or whatever, what is really infrared. Infrared just means long wavelengths. It has nothing to do with optics, really. And so an infrared regularization, like putting the system into a box, simply means that we do no longer allow wavelengths larger than a certain maximum size. If you have a box of 100 light years across, there cannot be any wavelengths fit into it that are longer than 100 billion light years. So we have a large wavelength cut off, and traditionally that's called infrared regularization. Later we will also study so-called ultraviolet cutoff, which is the situation where we do not allow wavelengths shorter than a certain smallest wavelength. But not now. Okay, so infrared regularization. If we do that, then remember what happens when you study a particle in a box. You know that for sure from quantum mechanics. When you put an electron into a box, then Its energy levels will be discretized. If you put a particle in a box, then the wave function has to vanish. For an electron, it has to vanish at the sides of the box. Here, we choose a box where the wave functions don't, or the fields don't have to vanish at the walls of the box. We're thinking of mirrors at the moment, which means that we have this reflectivity property. Or we could choose periodic boundary conditions. For the project, we will use so-called Dirichlet boundary conditions, where the field vanishes at the boundary. All of these choices don't really matter for physical predictions if your box is really very, very large. If, on the other hand, you really work with actual mirrors, then you have to worry about describing the correct boundary conditions. But we are thinking of a box that's so large that the actual choice of boundary conditions is a matter of convenience. The predictions about the physics right here and now cannot depend on the boundary conditions. So now, if you have your quantum field in a box, then you have, let's say, periodic boundary conditions, and therefore no longer do all plane waves fit into the box. The Fourier transform works with all plane waves, but no longer do all plane waves fit into the box, but only those which have an integer number of oscillations, right? Because we want periodicity in the box, let's say. So there needs to be an integer number of oscillations. And that means that the wave vector, the momentum vector, can only take a discrete set of values. It can only take the values 2 pi over L, where L is the size of the box, multiplied with an integer, the integer counting how many oscillations there are in the box, in the x direction, in the y direction, in the z direction. So we have n1, n2, n3 elements, each an element of z, a set of integers, positive and negative. L to the power 3 is the volume of our box. Then, and this is a standard result of Fourier theory, nothing particular to do with quantum field theory, it's just a standard result of Fourier theory, that we can now do a forward Fourier transform and a backward Fourier transform, and they take this shape. Consider the field, the quantum field, phi hat of x and t, but the same would be true for any field. We're just doing a Fourier transform here. And we multiply it with e to the minus I x k. Remember, the forward Fourier transform has a minus sign over here. So we multiply with this Fourier factor, where, however, the k's are no longer living on all points of R3 in momentum space, but the k vector is always one of those vectors. Okay, so it's the k vectors are always of a grid in R3, the momentum space R3. So you do this Fourier transform from minus L half to L half. See, if the box is 100 billion light years across, it's 50 billion this way, 50 billion that way. So we do this Fourier transform, then divide by the square root of the volume, and then we get the Fourier transformed field. Very important, though, is that now not all values of k occur, but only those values of k occur, a discrete set of k values. And the inverse Fourier transform operates this way. You take those phi k of t, and you sum over all triplets k that can occur, all those guys. You sum over all of them, because it's no longer an integral, right? Multiply with the Fourier factor. Remember, it's a plus for the return Fourier transform. And divide by the square root of the volume, you get phi of x and t back. Now, what do we get if we use the Fourier if instead of the Fourier transform we use the Fourier series for the quantum field theory problem in a box? Then our Hamiltonian takes this form. Remember, we expect now that there's going to be a pi dagger pi and a phi dagger phi, because while phi and pi were real, their Fourier transforms are not, so this is just the usual thing. Then we have, as expected, omega k squared, so this is k squared plus m squared, also as expected. The Laplace operator becomes k squared, because under Fourier series transform, just like Fourier transform, derivatives become multiplications with k. If you don't remember why that is, just check it out. Imagine you're differentiating phi let's say you're differentiating phi with respect to x. Okay? So you're differentiating this thing with respect to x, right? So differentiate the left-hand side and the right-hand side. Differentiate this whole equation with respect to x. Then on the left-hand side, you have that phi gets differentiated with respect to x. On the right-hand side, the x derivative acts on this thing only, where it will pull down a k. Okay? So what we see is that whether we differentiate phi with respect to x, let's say with respect to x1, or we multiply phi k with respect to k1, same deal, same thing, up to a factor of I, right? So differentiation of phi of x is the same as multiplying phi k with k. Okay, so that's why we have here a k squared plus m squared instead of Laplacian plus m squared. And then if you go through the math, you find, and please do it as an exercise, you find that the commutation relations now have a Kronecker delta. And it couldn't be a Dirac delta because now it's discrete values of k, right? And the phis commute with each other, the pis commute with each other, the equations of motion are still the same as before. Here we go, all of them. And remember, I brought last time this book along from Mukhanov and Vinitsky, a book that we are following at the moment. And at this point, Mukhanov goes into shortcuts. And we will go a little bit more into detail about what's happening next. So now we are closer to the harmonic oscillators because we have a Kronecker delta here rather than a Dirac delta. But there's this little matter of this, for example, right? That the signs don't seem to match. And that has to do with the third difficulty, which is hermeticity. Remember that the field is classically real. One moment, please. The field is classically real, quantum mechanically self-adjoint. Same for the canonically conjugate field, classically real valued, quantum mechanically self-adjoint. Yes?
So just we had in the last thing is we had a problem with the quantum field over momentum space being continuous. We just rediscretized it to get rid of the problem.
Can you please repeat that? You're saying that.
So we had these phis defined for continuum of k.
Yes.
And so and now it's giving us a problem. We just rediscretized it to make it.
Yes, we discretized it, but we didn't just discretize it by declaring it to be discrete, but by choosing a physical setup that makes it discrete. And that is the setup where it's all happening in a huge box with periodic boundary conditions. Yep.
So right now we have in our Fourier transform definition, we have L. Means that the physics depends on the size of the box we chose.
We would think so, yes. But ultimately, it doesn't. If L is big enough, it doesn't matter. For large enough L, it doesn't matter at all. It's clear from the physics that whether you have a wall that's like 100 billion light years away or 110 billion light years away, it shouldn't affect our physics, right? And that will also come out mathematically. Okay, so we have a hermeticity problem because these guys are Hermitian, all right, but the Fourier transforms are not. Instead, if a function is real valued, its Fourier transform has the property that its complex conjugate is, you know, if this were not the operator valued, it would be phi star of k is equal to phi of minus k. And operator valued, it means that the phi k dagger is equal to phi of minus k. Easy to check from the Fourier transform. And the same is true for the canonically conjugate momentum field. So definitely, the Fourier transformed fields are not self-adjoint operator valued. Oh, by the way, here in the bracket, I'm deriving that equation. The fact that the canonically conjugate, the Hermitian conjugate to phi of k is phi of minus k, not phi of k. If it were phi of k, it would mean self-adjointness, but it's phi of minus k, so it's not. And that's the equation. Please check it yourself. Now, but this is not good, because the quantum mechanics of harmonic oscillators requires that our position operators are self-adjoint. The momentum operators are supposed to be self-adjoint. Mukhanov glances over that and just goes ahead and calculates as if they were self-adjoint, but they're not, right? So those guys are not amplitudes of harmonic oscillators. Now, clearly, it's not a deep problem, because we can just decompose that into a self-adjoint and an anti-self-adjoint part, just the same way that we would decompose complex numbers into real imaginary part. The whole thing is linear with the harmonic oscillators, so we should get away with it. But how exactly does this work? the issue is a little deeper, because it's the origin also of the fact that the Kronecker delta doesn't require that k has to match. You see, if k matches k prime, that's not when this thing peaks. Basically, what this is telling us is that the canonically conjugate to phi k is not pi k, but it's pi minus k. Or in other words, it's pi k star, or pi k Hermitian conjugated. So how do we properly treat this? Well, there is a way to do it, and this is not usually done. There are ways around this, and in the project, I will explain to you a way around this. but here, let's just barrel through it just to see how you can straightforwardly get it done anyway. But maybe it's a good time to tell you already how we do it in the project. Remember, we did two kinds of Fourier transform. We did the regular Fourier transform, and then we had to deal with the Dirac delta. Then we said, nah, we don't want a Kronecker delta. So we do it with the Fourier series transform in a huge box with periodic boundary conditions. That gave us a discretization, but we're still faced with this problem that the k minus k thing doesn't match up. Our coefficients of the Fourier transform, our Fourier transformed fields, phi k, pi k, they are not self-adjoint. So let's ask, is there a kind of Fourier transform such that the Fourier transform coefficient, so that the Fourier transformed field, is still self-adjoint valued? And there is. There is a kind of Fourier transform which takes a real valued function into real coefficients. That's what we want. We don't want the real valued function at the end. We want coefficients, right? Our phi k is not a function of k, it's coefficients, right? Because the k only take discrete set of values. Right? We have a discrete set of modes. It's just that those guys are not self-adjoint. But there is a way to do a Fourier transform such that the Fourier transform function, or Fourier transform collection of coefficients, whatever you want to call it, is still real-valued, classically, or self-adjoint operator-valued quantum mechanically. And that, all we have to do for that purpose is consider our quantum field in a huge box. But now, instead of periodic boundary conditions, let's use boundary conditions that require that the field vanishes at the boundary of the box. In this case, we can do a so-called Fourier sine transform. And a Fourier sine transform uses not these Fourier factors, but instead just the sine part. There's also a Fourier cosine transform. But in any case, the Fourier sine transform also works. And then the transform thing is self-adjoint operator valued, and the whole thing is much easier. And we can skip certain steps that we will have to do now. But normally, people don't bother with the Fourier sine transform, and they work with the Fourier series transform that we just worked with. And so let's just barrel through it and see how that works out. Okay. So ultimately, we want to identify in the quantum field proper harmonic oscillators, where everything is in order, the commutation relations, the self-adjointness, the equations of motion, and just a discrete set of them, so that we don't deal with the Dirac delta, but the Kronecker delta. Okay, so we want to identify inside the quantum field some proper harmonic oscillators, QK and PK, which obey these equations of motion of ordinary quantum mechanics, the ordinary commutation relations of ordinary quantum mechanics, and which are also properly self-adjoint. How can we do that? Well, here's an answer for that. With our field above, with the usual Fourier series transform that we did. Okay, so we work with this thing here. You know, these guys here. Everything seems fine except for that business. And we have that the phi k are not self-adjoint, and neither are the pi k. So how can we identify in this system proper quantum mechanical harmonic oscillators? Well, here's how we can do it. Namely, these are proper harmonic oscillators, and they are hidden in our quantum field in this way. The phi k's, which are not self-adjoint, can be written as a linear combination of q k's and q minus k's, plus I times. See, this is self-adjoint. That is self-adjoint, but here's the factor of I in front. So the whole thing is not self-adjoint, as it shouldn't be. Plus, this business here is a pk minus p minus k, with the prefactor of I over omega k times 2. That factor of 2 should really be over there. That's how the harmonic oscillators are really sitting in there. And the time derivative of this, of course, is the pi k. And again, I invite you to check that this is what comes up. So if we take ordinary harmonic oscillators, where the k take those discrete values, then we can find them inside our quantum field in this way. If we make that answer, you can verify that these guys obey the equations of motion. They obey the hermeticity conditions. Not that this is Hermitian. This is as it should be, such that phi k dagger is phi of minus k. It comes out from these ansatz. And the canonical commutation relations hold. Equation of motion, canonical commutation relations, and the hermeticity conditions. And that's a big deal, because once we have this, we know how to represent these things concretely, mathematically. Remember, that this is what we set out to do. We set out to solve the equations of motion of quantum field theory on Minkowski space, consisting of the commutation relations, the equations of motion, and the hermeticity conditions. We were looking for mathematical objects that obeyed that, functions of space and time that obeyed those three conditions, equations of motion, canonical commutation relations, and hermeticity. And now we know how to do that, because we can represent, I mean, these guys we know. We can represent them as, let's say, position and momentum operators on some abstract Hilbert space. We know how to represent them as multiplication and differentiation operators, each one of them on a Hilbert space. We also can represent them as A and A dagger operators if we want. We have ways to write down the quantum mechanics of those things. Everything about it is known. It's just ordinary harmonic oscillators, quantum harmonic oscillators. The mass of it is completely clear. We know how to write down the kinematics, the dynamics, the whole thing. We can go to a Q representation or a P representation and whatnot. Remember, though, that these are just auxiliary harmonic oscillators. These are not harmonic oscillators that consist of a spring made out of iron and it's oscillating and it's quantized. That's not what it is. These are mathematical constructs. These are just mathematical harmonic oscillators that obey the equations of motion of a quantum harmonic oscillator that we use in order to solve the problem of quantum field theory. So all of those PKs and QKs we can represent as A and A daggers and multiplication or differentiation operators acting on some Hilbert space. And therefore, we can represent this one. But if we can represent the phi k, we can represent the phi of x just by Fourier transform. And it turns out that even though this looks complicated, there's a much easier way to write the same thing. Namely, remember, when you have a harmonic oscillator, then you usually write down creation and annihilation operators. And the annihilation operator is usually defined in this way. It has the commutation relation with its adjoint of being equal to 1. So AK commutator with AK dagger is 1. Comes out automatically if the X and the P's obey the usual commutation relations with the IH bar on the right-hand side. Then because of the way that these prefactors are arranged, you see that this cancels out that, etc. So you get the commutation relations, the usual ones between A and A dagger, arising from the ones for the Q's and the P's. If you make that definition, if you define the A and A dagger operators for our harmonic oscillators, then we see that the phi K actually can be represented simply as this. It is up to some prefactor, 1 over square root of 2 omega K, simply the sum of the A K plus A minus K dagger.
So the mathematics forces us to have this raising and lowering operator, or we could have some other ansatz and avoid it.
No, we don't have to use this. Yeah. We could choose never to work with the A and A daggers. We simply have the Q's and the P's. Okay. It's fine too. Later on, of course, we will use the A and A daggers, and they will suggest the particle interpretation of the field theory. But for the moment, we are not concerned with interpreting the theory. We're just concerned with finding a solution, finding actual phi k of x and t's that will do this. And we can find that because we can find q's of k and t and p of k and t using the usual way to solve the ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators. So I hope you see now how being able to solve the regular quantum harmonic oscillator allows us to solve the quantum field theory completely. We will spell it out, of course, pretty soon, how that works out concretely. But you see, hopefully, how that goes. We have an infinite number of harmonic oscillators. For every triplet of numbers k, we have a harmonic oscillator. We have a q, we have a p, we have a Hamiltonian, etc. And the total Hamiltonian of our quantum field theory will be the sum of the Hamiltonians of those little harmonic oscillators. And total ground state of the quantum field theory will be the tensor product of the ground states of all of those individual harmonic oscillators. So the quantum field theory is made out of an infinity of quantum systems, each one being just a regular harmonic oscillator. So for every k vector, we have a harmonic oscillator. And so we have infinitely many systems, each of which is a regular harmonic oscillator, and the total system is the tensor product of all of them. So, what I claimed needs to be proven. Leave that again, the proof of that I leave to you. So we have to show that the Hamiltonian takes a simple form, Indeed, the Hamiltonian takes this form, which is really very suggestive, right? So it's what I just mentioned, namely that the Hamiltonian of the quantum field, right? Hamiltonian of the quantum field is really just the sum of the Hamiltonians of all those little harmonic oscillators. The equations of motion are the ones that need to be obeyed. The canonical commutation relations are these, even though the Q's and the P's obey the usual ones. So here we have a K and minus K prime, but still, the ansatz is such that, indeed, the Q's and the P's obey the usual commutation relations, if you remember, these ones. And the hermeticity condition also comes out right, because this is suitably chosen, this ansatz. And now, via the inverse Fourier series, we can now also obtain a representation of our original field phi hat of x. Namely, we can do the Fourier series transform backwards, which was originally, if you remember, this one. The forward Fourier transform goes like that. If we have a particle in a box with periodic boundary conditions, then the Fourier transform gets us to the modes in this way. Then there's the inverse Fourier series, which goes like that. So we get phi hat of x and t from the individual modes. Remember that now it's only a sum rather than integral because the k values are discretized. Now, if we express our phi k in the way that we discussed, in terms of the q's and the p's, in this clever way so that we decompose the phi k in terms of harmonic oscillators, then this series takes a new form in terms of those harmonic oscillators. And that's what I just showed. It's over here. Right? So this is what happened to this sum. We have the sum over the square root of the volume. And then, because we decomposed the phi k into the q's and the p's, we got this thing. And you see there's a cosine now and a sine, etc. So we do know what the quantum mechanics of the qk is. And we do know what the quantum mechanics of the pk is. They're all just harmonic oscillators, after all. And we do know, for example, that when all those harmonic oscillators are in their lowest energy state, then the quantum field theory is in its lowest energy state. Because the Hamiltonian of the quantum field theory is just the sum of the Hamiltonians of the individual harmonic oscillators. And we do know that in that state, where all of the harmonic oscillators are in their ground state, in that state, a harmonic oscillator has, for its amplitude, the expectation value 0. But if you actually measure where the harmonic oscillator is sitting, it's probably not 0, not at the bottom of the potential. It's likely to be elsewhere, because there's this Gaussian spread for the ground state wave function, right? And similarly here, even though the quantum field may be in its ground state, if you actually measure the qk, you're likely to find that it's not 0. Or the p, it's not 0. There are fluctuations, right? So the harmonic oscillators, if you measured all those harmonic oscillators' amplitudes, then you would find something, not generally 0. Which means that if you measure the phi of x, generally, you're not going to find 0. There are going to be vacuum fluctuations. Even in the lowest energy state of the quantum field, you would not expect, if you measured the phi hat of x at all positions, you would not expect that you find 0 everywhere. Instead, you would find some amplitudes.
Mm-hmm. You have a problem with getting infinity because there are infinite modes. And each one has a non-zero ground energy.
Yes, the energy actually sums up to infinity, that's right. And we will have to deal with that. That's right. And also the fluctuations completely get out of hand. It's true that the fluctuations, I mean, each harmonic oscillator fluctuates. And it turns out that if you ask, what is the standard deviation of the fluctuations of phi at the position x? Well, it will have contributions from all of those harmonic oscillators. Because each harmonic oscillator contributes in the Fourier transform. And the Fourier transform mixes all the modes. Just like the other way around, the Fourier transform mixes all the positions, right? If you want to know what the contributions to mode one would, mixes all of them. So all of them contribute. And it turns out that even though each harmonic oscillator contributes only a little to the fluctuations in phi, the total is infinite. As long as you just take a finite number of harmonic oscillators, it's going to be fine. There's a finite amplitude of oscillations. But if you take all of them, it's infinite. So it would seem that the field is just fluctuating like mad. It's totally, I mean, the standard deviation is infinite. The expectation value is zero in the ground state, but the standard deviation is infinite. It turns out that it's not so bad. Because if you want to actually measure the amplitude of phi at a position, you will find you can't. Because there is no measurement instrument that would measure exactly at just one point. You always smear at some, to some extent at least. And we will go through that calculation in full detail. We will calculate not what the standard deviation of the fluctuations of phi are at an exact position, but we will average it. We will smear it over a little volume. We will say, let's say we have a detector that measures the amplitude phi. It measures the average of the amplitude phi in a certain volume. We will find that the expectation value for that average is zero. And we find that the standard deviation for what you find as the average is going to be finite. If you make the box or the little volume where you average over smaller and smaller, the standard deviation goes larger and larger. But if you have a larger box, then the standard deviation gets small. And that's because the fluctuations at one point are partially undone by the fluctuations of a neighboring point. See, at one point it fluctuates very widely, positively, let's say. And the neighboring point, it might fluctuate very strongly negatively. So that when you take the average, actually it's sort of finite what comes out. It's not that big. And that's exactly what's happening. As you average over the over phi, over the amplitudes of phi over a finite region, you find that the standard deviation is actually finite and dependent on the size. That calculation is crucial later in cosmology, because there we have quantum fluctuations on large scales, quantum fluctuations in small scales. So we will want to calculate what is the size of the fluctuations as a function of the scale over which we average. This is ultimately the result. This is the prediction that we want to check in the sky. The prediction is that fluctuations of very small scale would be larger in amplitude, and of very large scale would be in smaller in amplitude. Except that this behavior is modulated by the fact that the universe is expanding, and that interferes with this, as we will find out. In any case, so here we see how the fluctuations of those individual harmonic oscillators of the modes get inherited by phi of x. Also, it's really easier. Eventually, we will not work with this representation, but instead, we will work with that's much easier, right? So we will express phi k in terms of the ak plus a minus k dagger. That thing stays relatively simple, even on expanding spacetimes and around black holes and so on. So that will be the representation of choice. But I just wanted to make the point that you can go all the way. You can express those guys in terms of q's and p's for the individual harmonic oscillators of each mode. And you can go all the way and express this thing in terms of phi of x. So that you never need to talk about modes, and never need to talk about raising and lowering operators. As we see here, you can express the whole thing the field itself in terms of the Qs and the Ps of the harmonic oscillators. But let me stress again that this Q has nothing to do with positions. Okay? This has nothing to do with momenta. Okay? This is just an abstract harmonic oscillator, and that is its time derivative. Okay? These are not actual positions and momenta somewhere in space. Because the degrees of freedom that we are dealing with here are the degrees of freedom of a quantum field. And its degrees of freedom are not position and momenta. Its degrees of freedom are amplitudes and rates of change of amplitude. Okay? So you should think of the Qs and the Ps having to do with amplitudes and rates of change of amplitude. They don't happen in space. They happen in amplitude space, these things. So not in not at a particular location, but in momentum space. Right? So as you can see here, we have, this is the amplitude of a quantum field, not at a particular location in space, but at a particular momentum, because you Fourier transform it, right? So this is the amplitude of a quantum field at a particular momentum. So we are looking at a particular momentum, which is to say a particular wavelength. So we are looking at a wave which is traveling with wave vector given by k. So we know in which direction it is traveling. What we don't know yet is what is the amplitude of the wave. That is what the phi is saying, right? So k is telling us in which direction the wave is propagating. Phi of k is telling us what the amplitude of the wave is, the degree of freedom of how large is the amplitude of this wave which is propagating in that direction. And the pi of k is telling us how quickly is that amplitude changing in time. Okay? And then the qk and the pk you can think of as this, as the, basically, if it weren't for this minus k business and so on, it's basically to say that the qk is the phi k and the p is the pi k, right? So the q's and the p's here are basically just telling what is the amplitude of the wave which has this wavelength, and the p is telling us how quickly is it changing. It's just that, as we see here, that the phi k is really consisting of two harmonic oscillators, one in the k direction, one in the minus k direction. Or vice versa, each one of those q's and p's contributes to two of them, to a momentum in this direction and a momentum in the opposite direction. They conspire. So you have a wave traveling this direction, a wave traveling in that direction, and both of them have consist of harmonic oscillators, and they mix. Ultimately, this is because the Laplacian is squaring the frequencies, right? It's a second derivative, so you get an omega squared, and so you get as the root of it a positive and a negative, right? So if you have a k vector and a minus k vector, they have the same omega, right? Because k squared and minus k squared is the same thing, and that allows them to mix. And this is what's actually happening over there. All right. But just keep in mind that ultimately what we will be mostly using is this convenient thing here. So mathematically, that's easier. But conceptually, I think it's easier to see that this is what's going on. There are harmonic oscillators, abstract quantum harmonic oscillators, out of which the phi of x is made. All right. Now you may wonder, how did I come up with this? Well, I just calculated it brute force. But one moment. The thing is, it's not unique. There are other ways to do it as well. There are other decompositions of phi k into harmonic oscillators, which is not really a problem. It just means that there are many ways that we can represent our quantum field in terms of known quantities. But there's one difference. It makes one difference. Namely, if we do it this way, then this is the unique way in which the lowest energy state of the harmonic oscillators of the Qs and the P is the lowest energy state of the quantum field. Or put it differently, this is the way to do it if you want that the Hamiltonian takes this simple form. There are other ways to do it, but then the Hamiltonian may take a much more complicated form. If you do it in other ways, you can express your field phi in harmonic oscillators, but then if you take their ground state, the ground state of all those harmonic oscillators, then it's not the lowest energy state of the quantum field. Which is to say that the vacuum state of the field is not given by the tensor product of those harmonic oscillators. Now you might think, all right, but that settles it. We just choose that one, which gives us the simple harmonic oscillator, you know, the simple way of writing the quantum field theoretical Hamiltonian in this way as the sum of the harmonic oscillators of the Qs and the Ps, and such that the ground state of the quantum harmonic oscillators, the constituent harmonic oscillators, is the lowest energy state of the field, which is the vacuum state, and that it is. Not so fast. It turns out that in quantum field theory on curved space, as we will see later when we go through all of this very carefully and slowly, as we will see later, in quantum field theory on curved space, the lowest energy state of a quantum field is not actually the vacuum state. Generally, it's not. It's a very weird thing, but it's the case. The vacuum state is not necessarily, and generally it isn't, the state of lowest energy state. And by that I mean the state of no particles. The state of no particles can be energetically a little higher than the absolute ground state. There is a subtle reason for that. Very important one, though. And that will require us to be very careful about this business. We will find that, yes, there are many ways in which we can represent our field in terms of harmonic oscillators, but we have to choose it very cleverly, such that the ground states of the harmonic oscillators really give us the vacuum state, which may not be the lowest energy state. And that has to do with the fact that if you take harmonic oscillators and you change their properties on the fly. See, these harmonic oscillators are fixed. They don't change in time. I mean, they don't change their frequency in time. But imagine you have harmonic oscillators that change their frequency in time. Then what's the ground state? What's the lowest energy state? What's the no excitation state? It's a non-trivial thing, because you can have excitation because of the motion. Okay, so we will have to be careful with this. Now, was there another question? Yes?
Yeah, so it's just that when you're describing the phi hat as an amplitude, since it's operator value, do you really mean that it's eigenvalues on some?
Yeah, what I mean is, in principle, it's an observable. You could measure that, you get a value, and that's an amplitude that you could then take. Yeah. Okay, so okay, so for now, we have solved the problem. We solved, using our ansatz above, the quantum field theoretical equations of motion, namely we solved the equations of motion phi dot is pi, the Klein-Gordon equation, hermeticity condition, canonical commutation relations. We solved it implicitly. I didn't spell out everything. But, you know, the moment we have expressed the phi of x and t in terms of operators that are just ordinary harmonic oscillators, we're really done, because those harmonic oscillators we can express as multiplication differentiation operators on Hermite wave functions and stuff like that. We will do it much more explicitly later on. Or we can express it in terms of Einer-Degger operators, one for each momentum k, and so on. Now, we were talking about the quantum fluctuations of the field. We were saying that since those Qs and Ps fluctuate, that thing should fluctuate. Okay, so how do we actually calculate that? So in principle, we solve the system of infinitely many quantum harmonic oscillator degrees of freedom. So we have the QKs and the PKs. Remember, the Ks are triplets, which take discrete values. The harmonic oscillator Hamiltonians are these. And the frequencies are given by that. So the frequency of the harmonic oscillator for a particular wave vector is given by square root of k squared plus m squared, where m is the mass of the particle. The discrete values that k can take are written up here again. And now we begin by choosing a state of our quantum field theory. What does that consist of? Well, we choose a state for each one of the harmonic oscillators. And then the total state is the tensor product of all those states, because our quantum field simply consists of all those harmonic oscillators. Therefore, the Hilbert space is the tensor product of all the Hilbert spaces of the harmonic oscillators. And a state of the total quantum field theory, a pure state of the total quantum field theory, is the tensor product of the pure states of all of the individual harmonic oscillators. For simplicity, at the beginning, we may want to choose just the ground states of the harmonic oscillators. So, for example, the harmonic oscillators are all in their lowest energy states. And then preliminarily, we will call this state the vacuum state. But remember, later on, we will find that in expanding space-time, the vacuum state will not be the state of lowest energy. So then, when we are given the state, or we have chosen the state of the quantum field theory, then we can calculate the probability for finding values of QK or PK or linear combinations of them. Okay, because the total state of the system is the tensor product of the states of the individual harmonic oscillators. So for each harmonic oscillator, we can calculate the probability distribution of all sorts of its observables, such as the probability distribution for the Qs, the probability distribution for the Ps, or a probability distribution for the sum of them. Why the sum of them? Well, remember, if you want to know what phi of x is, it's a linear combination of the q's and the p's with some suitable prefactors there, right? So if we can work out what the probability distribution is for q, or the probability distribution for p, well, we can also work out what the probability distribution of the whole thing is, okay? But once we have the probability distribution for each one of those k, right, we can get the probability distribution for each of the phi of x's. Or we can work with the phi k. So we can work out what the probability distributions are of the qk, of the pk, and therefore we can work out what the probability distribution is for the individual phi k. For example, the probability distribution for the QKs is a Gaussian if the harmonic oscillator is in the ground state. And the width of the Gaussian is given by this, because the omega k is the, you know, the back driving force constant square root. So what I'm saying is that because we know everything about those individual harmonic oscillators, the state in which they are, we can work out the probability distribution for all of the phi k's and the pi k's, etc. And so it turns out that the probability distribution for finding a particular value for phi k, for the Fourier coefficient phi k, is given by this Gaussian here. So you take phi k, which remember is a complex number, and I'm skipping a few steps here, but in the project, I will guide you through exactly how to calculate these probability distributions. In fact, in an easier way, where you don't have to worry with complex conjugation and so on, because we will use the Fourier sine transform, where everything is real all throughout, and it's much more intuitive. In any case, in this situation here, the probability distribution the probability for finding a particular amplitude phi k Fourier coefficient phi k, that's a number here, right? So for finding actually that number, that particular real part, that particular imaginary part, is up to a normalization in front of it, is given by e to the power of minus omega k, and then phi k star, which is real. This is just a Gaussian probability distribution, which is to say that to find phi k's, phi k coefficient, if you measure the field, to find phi k coefficients which have sort of modest modulus is likely. Because obviously the prefactor has to be such that the probability distribution is normalized. So you have to find some value. But it's a Gaussian, which means that finding a large modulus phi k is unlikely. It's more than exponentially decaying. It's Gaussian decaying, right? So very large quantum fluctuations, very large values of phi k are unlikely. So what you can do is, in a computer, use this probability distribution. In the simplest case, just use this one. And say, I want to actually measure the quantum field. What can I expect to find? How is it going to look like? Phi of x. How is it going to look like if the quantum field was in its ground state? So what you can do is, you can say, I know the probability for finding each one of the Fourier coefficients. I know the probability distribution for them. So I draw from that probability distribution. So I consider the system in a box. I have these discrete values of k. And I take the first, 100 of those Fourier coefficients. So I'm not taking, I can't carry out the series to infinity, right? So I take the first so many coefficients. And each one of them, I draw from that probability distribution. Right? From the physical probability distribution. What's the probability distribution for finding a particular coefficient? This is it. I just draw from that. If your math software is a little bit sophisticated, it will allow you to do that. I mean, every piece of software like Maple and Mathematica and so on allows you to draw from a uniform probability distribution. Like, draw numbers uniformly between 0 and 1. But if it doesn't allow you to draw from an arbitrarily given probability distribution like this one, you can easily code something that allows you to draw from a given probability distribution. And so you draw your numbers. You draw your Fourier coefficients from the probability distribution that comes out of quantum field theory. And then you have your Fourier coefficients. But once you have a bunch of Fourier coefficients, you can plot your field. You just Fourier transform those coefficients. The whole thing is linear, right? So there's nothing lost if you do that. So once you have the phi k, you can then plot the phi of x. And here's an example of what you get. So if you draw, if this is the box here, then you take your first so many Fourier coefficients and draw each coefficient out of the probability distribution, where for each coefficient you have a different probability distribution, right? Because the omega k depends on k. So for every Fourier coefficient k, for every wave vector k, you get a different omega k, which means that the Gaussian gets narrower or wider. And so you get different probability distributions. Anyway, you draw from them, and then you get your phi k, and you plot, and you get something like this. This is a contour plot. This is a contour plot of phi of x drawn from that probability distribution. And so these are lines of equal value of phi of x. Means that if you were able to go out and measure phi of x for all x in the ground state, in the vacuum state, lowest energy state, in Minkowski space is all the same, then this is typically what you would expect to find for the amplitude. Except, as we discussed earlier, if you could really measure at a particular point, well, the fluctuations there are infinite. So how come that we get actually a reasonable picture and not one which is infinitely spiky? Which is really what the math is saying, that's infinitely spiky. Well, we get something that's reasonable and not infinitely spiky because we're not looking at all Fourier coefficients. If we were to add more and more Fourier coefficients, we would get more and more fine detail, of course, little ripples. You know, now we don't have ripples smaller than a certain size because we didn't take all triplets of k vectors into account. But as we add more and more Fourier coefficients, our Fourier transform will pick up more and more of these little nitty-gritty details there. And not only will you fill in details, but those details eventually pile up and make the whole thing totally wild, where you would have huge spikes coming out or going into it. So by cutting off the Fourier series, by only taking a finite number of the Fourier coefficients, we get a reasonable picture. And that is also physical. It's not just a mathematical thing. It's physical because, of course, there's no way that we could probe a field at a point itself. If, for example, realistically, we take an atom and have it interact with the electromagnetic field, then the atom will see the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. It will contribute, for example, to the paramagnetic and the diamagnetic forces, but and the Casimir forces and the van der Waals forces and so on. But the atom has a finite size. It actually, in effect, averages over the field at a certain scale. And that's why the atom sees more like this. It sees the electromagnetic field as fluctuating like this and not as fluctuating with arbitrarily large spikes. Nevertheless, those arbitrarily large spikes are the reason why in quantum field theory, when you study scattering theory, you get infinities, you get divergences. Because there you consider in the possibility of having particles getting arbitrarily close to each other, and then they probe their fluctuations to arbitrarily large, arbitrarily small distances, arbitrarily large fluctuations, and that leads to divergences. Anyway, so this was a quick way to get to quantum fluctuations and quantizing fields. I will, in the next lecture, tell you about the Schrödinger picture of quantum field theory. That's going to be very abstract stuff, but I think it's a lot of fun. And then we will start to go systematically and much more slowly through that same stuff, but on curved space. And we will see what happens when the harmonic oscillators are changing in time, because space-time is changing. Okay, that's it for today.